is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, once again, my friends, I am Micah Hanks. Once and forever, I will always be your one and only mouth of the South. And this, of course, is That Dark Disquiet, the weekly event known as, I should actually say, the weekly event horizon known as the Grailian Report. Welcome to the program. So glad to have you with us here again for another week in the weird. Caleb and Tyler taking a little time off because I think we're all due a bit of a stress-free vacation. It's been a very, very busy time. We're getting into that busy time of the year, and of course all the planning and promotion and everything leading up to Paradigm Symposium is indeed, well, it's a gift of an existence to be able to exist the way that I do. But of course it also gets busy sometimes, and so this week on the program we've got something very, very special that we've put together, and this is going to be a, with limited commercial interruption, a conversation, an in-depth conversation with one of our very favorite personalities. He is the co-host of Intrepid Radio and also the co-author of the upcoming book, along with Scott Allen Roberts, The Exodus Reality. It's none other than one of our very favorites and, of course, a gentleman that you'll be seeing at the Paradigm Symposium in October, Dr. John Ward of Luxor, Egypt. Now, he'll be joining us after the break. And this, again, will be with limited commercial interruption because I wanted to do something a little different this week. Every now and then, we're so into what we're doing here at Grailian International that we're hitting the news and we're hitting all the hot topics. We're trying to work in people who are going to talk about the esoteric or, you know, something strange or maybe something timely. Tonight, we get into a little of both of that. I plan to talk to John Ward about some timely issues, specifically what's going on right now in the Middle East, with specific focus on Syria, but then we're also going to talk about the esoteric and his work. We're going to talk a little bit about the occult, and we'll certainly talk a good bit about the history of the strange and the esoteric as it relates to his work and what drew him to Luxor, Egypt. If you don't know who Dr. John Ward is, he is someone, again, people who have attended Paradigm Symposium last year, people who listen to Intrepid Radio Sunday nights on KGRA. Of course, this immediately follows the Micah Hanks radio program every Sunday night. John is the co-host of the program with Scotty Roberts. He gets up at the absolute beyond the crack of dawn, Luxor, Egypt time, to co-host that program from across the mighty waters of the Atlantic every week with Scotty. He's just a fascinating person, and he's someone who, frankly, I enjoy talking to, but I have also begun to feel that we don't hear from enough on this program. And so tonight it'll be a special double feature of sorts where we spend an inordinarily lengthy amount of time discussing world affairs, history, the esoteric, and the unexplained with Dr. John Ward, a truly fascinating guy. But before we get to that, I have to throw out the inevitable. I think everybody, I wake up this morning and everyone's talking about Miley Cyrus's tongue and whether or not she's going to beat Gene Simmons in the freaky deaky contest of how far they can stick their tongue out of their face. And of course, whether Miley's behavior on stage last night at the video movie, or the MTV Video Music Awards, whether or not that would rival the weirdness that is expected of Lady Gaga. That is, when she can keep her clothes on. These days it seems that Lady Gaga wants to do more without wardrobe than with. And if she's not wearing clothes, at very least she'll show up on the runway wearing, what was it, meat? Like a meat suit? It's absurd. And so all I hear about today is, actually, let's take it all the way back to Sunday night. Here we see Miley Cyrus dancing around on stage and doing what she's doing. I love the screen caps that have shown up online of Will Smith and his family all sitting there, their jaws just kind of hanging agape, and they're sitting there looking at this display on stage, these weird giant teddy bears, you know, all this strange stuff. It's like, let's see who can out-weird each other now. And I noticed Sunday night that I'm, of course, doing my radio program on KGRA. It's 8 o'clock. Our numbers are down. There aren't as many people in the chat room, and I'm thinking, where did everybody go? My God, is there something happening? You know, I'm expecting, you know, literally, well, you know me, I'm not expecting the worst per se, but I keep my eye on the news. I keep my finger on the trigger, so to speak, you know, on what's happening in world events, and I'm looking at Syria. I'm looking at the things that are going on, some of the things that I plan to discuss with Dr. John later in the program. And, oh no, no, immediately we get off the air, and I'm, before I tune in to listen as I typically do, as I'm unwinding after our program, and I'm tuning in and I'm listening to Scotty Roberts and Dr. John do their program with Little Mo, and I'm sitting there, and I pull up my news feed, and all I'm seeing is Miley Cyrus, Miley Cyrus, Miley Cyrus. And so, sure enough, I haven't watched the actual performance. I refuse to sit there and watch the entire thing and take, what, 2-3 minutes out of my existence in order to observe this. But I've seen the pictures, her tongue and that great big, you know, styrofoam finger, you know, and the lack of an actual costume. You know, I don't know if you could call what she was wearing there, at least for half that performance. I don't know if you'd actually call that a costume. It was more like the lack thereof. And, of course, then it was flesh-toned to give further the impression that she's literally prancing around on stage naked. If she can't be naked, if she can't be Lady Gaga, she's going to do the next best thing. And at very least, for people whose bifocals perhaps were not attuned properly, she might have actually appeared naked there on stage two nights ago. But anyway, and so I'm waking up this morning. Here it is, doing my show prep, getting things together for the Graylin Report, and still, this is all I'm seeing. Everybody's talking about Miley Cyrus, Miley Cyrus, Miley Cyrus. And if it's not that, it's Lady Gaga. And yet, if we jump across the pond to Damascus, Syria, literally, Syrian officials are now saying that not only will an international attack against Syria become potentially hazardous, it may, quote, instigate chaos throughout the world. There was an interview that the Associated Press carried out this morning with a Syrian deputy foreign minister, Faisal Miqdad, and he said that airstrikes or other action against Syria would also trigger chaos and threaten worldwide peace and security across the board. Now, he spoke Monday in support for an international response that has been put on the table in response to this alleged chemical attack that took place over there in Syria a number of days ago. Again, as best I can understand, it is believed, and there is credible evidence to indicate that there has been a chemical attack, a chemical weapons attack, that the chemical weapons attack had been carried out by the Assad troops of President Bashar Assad, and that they were responsible for this, that now activists are saying has killed hundreds of individuals, some of them women and children. Well, the Obama administration, of course, is now saying that there could be military intervention, action taken as a result of this. In fact, they're also talking, quote-unquote, as a matter of fact, there was a CBS News report earlier today that had said that, quote, the Obama administration is now talking behind the scenes as if there's almost no doubt about Assad's use of chemical weapons. But as I understand, again, we are not 100% sure if this is the case. It is the likely scenario. We're just not 100% sure. Now, the Syrian government had denied, or at least held off on requests for UN investigators to come in and to look into this for a period of about 5 days. And because of the slow action in allowing UN investigators into the area, this apparently has also led to an extent, the belief that there may be something going on and that there may actually be something being withheld. In other words, the Syrian government, Assad, they're not being fully compliant, and they're not acting in a way that, if they were not responsible for the actual attack, that, again, news agencies are reporting has killed hundreds, they're not acting in a way that would be conducive to working with the UN and allowing them willingly into the country. They hold off for 5 days, then they finally allow these UN inspectors in on Monday, and lo and behold, snipers are involved, and apparently their ability to transport themselves to the site of the attack for investigation is inhibited by snipers firing at them, as the news agencies were reporting. This is definitely a disturbing situation. And furthermore, although we have very, very, very strong suspicions, the UN have literally only just now arrived. They're just now on the scene, so to speak, within the last couple of days. And yet, again, Senator Bob Corker, out of Tennessee, he'd appeared on CBS, I think maybe it was on, it was either Monday morning or it was Sunday sometime. He had said, quote, there's no question the administration is building support with our NATO allies, unquote, and apparently preparing for an intervention. I think on Sunday that there was actually a national security advisor with the Obama White House who had said, yes, we're laying out plans right now on the table for a strike, but that we will not do it alone and that we will go through the United Nations to attempt to try and get support from Russia just as well. Russia, who in the past has even supplied support for the Assad regime. So, you know, this is a very, very difficult and complex situation taking place in a very volatile and complex part of the world. It's not something that is very easily dealt with. And at least for part of the discussion tonight with John Ward, I do want to get into talking about this with him. And I've said it before on the program many times that it may not be the kind of thing that people always like to hear about and like to discuss. But does it involve elements of conspiracy? Certainly does. Does it involve things that are important to the listenership of this program, as they well understand, you being the erudite and enlightened individuals that you are? Yes, it does. And so we'll talk about that a bit, as well as esotericism with John Ward when we come back. It is the Graylian Report. I'm Micah Hanks. According to the Maya, the rain god Chalk created the vast oceans as he struck the clouds with his axe in ancient times. Some believe today that there may be more to these myths of strange beings, but no modern adventure will explore mysteries of our ancient past like the Ancient Alien Cruise, January 9th through the 13th, 2014. Set sail for a high seas adventure with experts in ancient mysteries and ancient astronaut theories, including author David Hatcher Childress, Dr. Robert Schock, and Hugh Newman. Go where mysteries of the ancients await you, along with a privately led shore excursion to Mayan ruins and a one-of-a-kind fine dining experience with your guides and speakers aboard one of the specialty restaurants on deck. Sign up early to ensure the speaker of your choice, and reservations made by September 1st will receive $25 per cabin onboard credit. The Ancient Alien Cruise will depart from Fort Lauderdale. Airfare, travel, and insurance is not included, but call for additional pricing and amenities. For details, visit ancientaliencruise.com or call Holiday Maker Travel toll-free at 877-642-4308. Embrace the spirit of adventure. ancientaliencruise.com. Discussing a range of topics as long and laborious as Miley Cyrus's tongue. Welcome back to the program. I'm Micah Hanks, and this is the Graylian Report. Hope you don't mind enjoying a chuckle with me on that one for mere moments, at very least. Hey, I had to talk about that. You know, again, it's timely. Well, I don't know if it's really important, but maybe it's more of a distraction than anything. What are your thoughts? Always love to hear from the listenership on these sorts of things. info@graylianreport.com if you'd like to email me. It's a fine way to reach the program. There are other ways as well. You can send us text messages, 828-367-7201. And, of course, we also can take phone calls, but I don't think we're going to do that tonight. I want you to sit back and listen, because I'm about to embark upon a bit of a quest in the sense that I'm going to be speaking with, indeed, one of the most fascinating people I've ever known, a good friend of mine across the great and mighty Atlantic, who resides now in Luxor, Egypt. I'm the kind of person that after many years of, I've lived a short time on Earth, 30 years, I feel like I'm about 130. It takes a lot to get me excited. And I know in recent memory, one time that I truly got excited, I was walking through the Minneapolis DoubleTree Hilton Hotel with my associate Chris Hayes, and I, as I'm walking along and I'm coming rounding this curve, there's this incredibly dapper dressed Englishman. And it was, of course, none other than our guest this evening, John Ward. I knew John only through photos and through correspondence. And the minute I saw him, we grabbed one another. We were so excited to meet. And we went immediately and had coffee, and we talked for several hours. And yet, being someone who I have so much that I want to talk with about, someone that I so often do talk with, we very seldom sit down and have an actual conversation because of the business of daily life. John Ward, he will be a speaker at Paradigm Symposium. He's our guest tonight on the Graylian Report. And I have to say this, that John, being a friend, being someone that I know, he's a man whose diversity in tastes and interests could probably rival the insect population of any rainforest, and the depth of his knowledge would probably rival that of the vastness of the Sahara itself. And so, without further ado, welcome to the Graylian Report, John Ward.
Thank you very much, Mike.
It was all improv,
what an
too.
Introduction.
It was all improv. Oh goodness, I'm working on something tonight, John. I'm going to try and be more verbose than Scotty Roberts.
Sorry, say again.
I said I'm going to try and be more verbose than Scotty Roberts. So let's see if I can do it.
Well, I think you've really won, haven't you?
I guess
did
only
I say that? Ooh.
Only time will tell. So how are things in Egypt? I know it's a beautiful place and you're glad to be there. And how are things going right now? I know over here on this side of the pond, we keep hearing things about Egypt. I know you're enjoying your time because your interests in Egypt, of course, have to do with the esoteric. So how are things going in that department?
Well, everything at the moment is fine. I mean, as you hear us on Sunday evenings for you, Monday mornings for me here on in Egypt, when we do Intrepid Radio with Scotty, mm-hmm. Giving everybody a lowdown on what's happening here in Egypt. It's very diverse. You see what the international news media is portraying, and then you see what you read on the internet and the alternative news network, shall we say. And then you hear what I've got to say, and it's very difficult to know who's telling the truth nowadays. And I suppose the man behind the curtain is ever prevalent at this present moment, because we really do not know. We don't know who's pulling the strings or what's going on. But one thing is happening here, and that is that we're safe. No problems here in Luxor. We're having a fantastic time. Both Maria and I are getting ready to go to Gebel Sisila, back to site again on Monday. We're going to be there for 6 weeks on board our little Dahabir, our little sailing boat. So we've got that to look forward to. Work-wise, it's fantastic. Articles, journals, ever so busy as always. Both Scotty and I, we just finished the Exodus Reality, as you know, and that's going to be published in October. And we're going to do the preview at the Paradigm Symposium. So it's all systems go, really. We haven't really allowed, both Maria and I, we haven't really allowed the revolution, so to speak, to interfere, I should say, with our work schedule and our life here. I think that Luxor provides that. It provides that kind of safety bubble, so to speak. I mean, we still go out riding along the Nile every morning. I still tend to my gardens, and we still walk around the village as normal, and we're greeted with respect, as per usual, and we haven't seen any. We've had our own problems here. I mean, there's no escaping that. We in the very beginning days of the last revolution, we had a few problems here. A few protests that got a bit nasty, but they were soon squashed, and within a couple of days, it was all over. As I mentioned on the radio this morning, coming back from Cairo yesterday, one thing I did notice with Luxor, and I suppose I don't see it that often, so for me it was a new thing to see, I suppose. So it was something that caught my eye immediately. It was the heavy military presence which has built up over the past couple of weeks. And I hadn't noticed this, I will be honest. And I only noticed it last night driving through Luxor as we have to cross the River Nile to get back home. And so we have to drive right through the center of town and way out and then cross over the main bridge to cross over into the west bank of Luxor itself, but on every street corner near enough, there seemed to be an armored personnel carrier with the Egyptian army on top, all looking very smart and ready to extinguish anybody's life who come anywhere near them. Very serious, very serious. But at security, yes, it's been beefed up. One could really see there is a difference. There is a difference. But we felt secure. We didn't feel threatened in any way. I mean, having grown up outside London during the 70s, I was used to the IRA blowing up bombs all over the place. So for me, it's the norm. But for Maria, being a Swedish girl, it's a little bit different for her. I mean, they haven't been at war, Christ, 200, 300, 400 years, as I think it is.
Yeah.
So for her, it's quite different. But for me, I'm kind of used to it. So it doesn't faze me as much, I must admit.
Wow. You know, and again, I ask someone like you, someone that I know who's there in Luxor, Egypt, I ask you not, this is for the benefit of the listeners, not to diminish what maybe we're being told here in the West with regard to what we see every day on the news in Egypt, but because I think, conversely, that here in the West, people were so far removed from the way of life in the Middle East. We're so far removed from the culture and perhaps even coming to terms with a fundamental understanding of culture in that part of the world for Westerners is something that is virtually impossible. It's very unique. You're a person who, because of your esoteric interests, which we'll get into here in a bit, brought you away from England, brought you to locations like Luxor and like Silsila, which we'll talk about in a moment just as well. And this is a unique kind of a charmed life in a way that you live in this heart of madness, and yet you describe it as beautiful. Again, this is not to diminish what we read about here in the West, but I think that, again, there are aspects to what is reported that paint a picture that Westerners perceive without a full understanding of all the implements. And so it's for me...
You're touching, Micah. Sorry to talk over you there.
No.
But you're touching upon a very subject that both Maria and I have discussed at length. Mm-hmm. With expats that are still living here, who have the diehard expats who haven't left. I mean, because they've left in their hundreds since the first revolution, they haven't returned, and there's only a few of us left. But you are touching upon a subject that we is very close to our hearts, because it is very difficult. On one hand, you have this mass international media that's portraying these horrific scenes. And I'm seeing them on my own television here. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've got over 1,000 channels. It's something like 2,000 to 3,000 channels on our satellites. It's ridiculous. but we keep abreast of all of the news, as you know. And, you know, when we watch the television, we sit down and we watch an either Al Jazeera, which is biased beyond any realm of the imagination.
No, it's a news agency.
Or if you watch the BBC, or if you're watching Sky or CNN or Fox News, which is more entertainment than anything else, really. You know, you can see that these guys, these reporters, they're doing the best job they think they can do. But at the end of the day also, they are missing the bigger issue, and that is the difference in culture. Mm-hmm. And that is something that you've just picked up on. And as I say, it's the biggest component, actually. It's the biggest component of this scaremongering. And I think that's the only way you can put it. It is scaremongering. On the international news channels, where they say, you know, they show this one man here be shooting another man, and then he'll jump on his head, and then some man will come along and kick him, and then once he's dead and his brains are splattered all over the floor, they pick him up and they throw him off a roof. And everybody on the international news is going, and everybody at home is going,
and then they say, This is Egypt.
And then they say, this is the Middle East. This is Egypt.
Right.
Don't go there. It's not safe.
Yes.
And I look at it and I think, okay, it's horrific, and you cannot diminish that, and I'm not condoning it by any stretch of the imagination here. It is horrific. But you've got to remember, it is a different culture. These guys fight, and when they fight to the death. It's not a case of a slap around the face and say, oh, I'll meet you at dawn, sir, with your pistols ready and so forth.
Right.
You know, it's not the old gentleman's way of war. Oh, you fire the shots first, old chap, and then fire back after, and I'll give another tally, okay? No, it's not. These guys fight, and when they fight to the death. We've got problems here in the village that have been here since I moved here, and they've been here for hundreds of years, and I'm not exaggerating that. You know, where one family have had a grudge against another family, it's like something you see in Hollywood, and they make these films out of it. There was a Western actually not so long ago which I watched. I thought it was fascinating. I can't remember. It was called the McCoys, was it? It was an American Western series. I think it was called the McCoys with Kevin Costner.
Probably
great program. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. But that was about a warring family. Mm-hmm. And they were fighting over a period of, say, 50 to 60 years, and in the end they all made up and kissed and happy, and everybody lived happily ever after. Here, that doesn't happen. If one gets killed, then it's eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. Mm-hmm. And it goes with that. Just before President Morsi was ousted, there was a problem here just down the river. Between Christians and Muslims. And it got rather heated. It wasn't in the international news media. You won't have heard of it. But unfortunately, there were some casualties on the Muslim side to start with. But in retaliation, an entire family unit of Christians were completely and utterly annihilated, wiped off the face of the earth. Their houses were destroyed, and they were destroyed within them completely. That goes beyond eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. But that what I'm trying to paint for you is that when it comes to this kind of anger, there's no remorse involved. It is pure, unabated anger. And it's very difficult to put into words how one perceives it. From a Western point of view, we see it and we think it's horrific. And it doesn't conform to our Western standards of living. Right. But here, it is expected. It's the norm. If there's a fight in the local village, all the men turn out with their sticks or their guns, and they will join in that fight until there is a mediation involved. And then the sheikh or the local imam will become involved, and there's a mediation, and peace is restored until the next time.
It's very much the essence of the ancient tribe. You know, the people move together as one. They defend...
Well, that's it, exactly, Mike. It is very tribal. I mean, take Libya, for example. We've only just recently gone in there. We've removed Gaddafi and his so-called henchmen and returned Libya back to its people. What many people don't realize, I suppose, is that when we say return to their people, are we referring to the population or are we referring to the 12 tribes? Because that's what Libya was. And Gaddafi's tribes that he belonged to, that he was the head of, controlled those tribes and kept them in order. He stopped the infighting. Prosperity then reigned. He was allowed to sell his oil and his mineral rights and so forth and so forth. And he grew Libya to what it was today. Regardless of the fact that he did some heinous acts and was involved in terrorism and so forth,
certainly.
That's okay. We'll put that to one side, and let's not condone that for a second.
Sure.
But we now remove him, and we've got chaos. It seems always the thing that we go in, we remove the key component that we think is the negative aspect of it, not realizing what the ramifications of that will be. I mean, look at Iraq. Iraq is still a nightmare. It's still a mess, and it's going to continue to be one. And until the men who sit in these boardrooms and put out these orders to go here, there, and everywhere and intervene in this particular government or intervene in that particular government or intervene in these particular affairs, until they learn about the culture and the history, I don't think they're going to be coming up with the right decisions.
Yeah.
There was a very interesting thing that someone posted to my posted on Facebook the other day. It was to do with the Malawi museum here in Egypt that was unfortunately ransacked during the revolution. And it was horrendous. We lost over 1,000 different artifacts. And slowly they're being returned, thankfully. One by one they're being found and returned back to their rightful place. And someone posted something about Islam. And it was a derogatory comment. And I posted immediately that I cannot condone those kind of statements in an open forum. Keep them to yourself. They're personal statements. Keep them to yourself. This isn't the place for them. But I did make one comment, and I said, if we cannot even begin to understand our history and where we have come from and what it has taken to get to where we are, how on earth are we going to contemplate where we are going and what our future will hold?
Absolutely. You know, and you can laugh if you want, but this is the thing. I think so many people are so far removed. They don't have any concept, let alone cultures, heritage, you know, and things like this elsewhere in the world. They don't understand their own background, their own heritage, their own culture. I've got sitting right here on my desk with me as we're talking. Again, you can laugh. You have my permission. The Complete Idiot's Guide to Middle East Conflict. Now, that's the Cliff Notes edition. I've got other books about this, but the thing is I don't think anybody else typically reads that kind of thing because they want to look at it and they want to say, let them to themselves, let them fight it out, or conversely, well, we'll have to go over there and fix it, not understanding that it's not so simple for someone simply to intervene. What often happens with a schoolyard fight? Teacher intervenes, kids, let's make up, you guys be friends now, but will they really be friends? No. Because that anger, the aggression, it's a simple explanation.
I know it was.
But that simple, okay, peaceful. Let's be peaceful, kids. Now, you guys don't fight. 5 minutes later, the kids are back out on the playground fighting again because the seeds of the aggression have not been dealt with by mere intervention alone. Now, this brings us somewhat to the situation with Syria. Literally, before you and I began this conversation, John Kerry here in the United States has made a press statement. And additionally, a senior Syrian official has said that, quote, his country will defend itself against any international attack and will not be an easy target as the U.S. and other countries have begun to ramp up their so-called rhetoric in response to the alleged chemical weapon attack that occurred now. Was it 6-7 days ago? I know that U.N. Officials were denied for 5 days the ability to enter. There's some question about whether there actually was a chemical attack. And now, as they've tried to enter this morning, we've heard, and you and I spoke briefly about this earlier, that there were apparently snipers firing at them.
Yes.
This situation is looking very bad, but now literally what the national security advisors have been saying in the Obama administration is that they're looking at putting out plans for an intervention, going in there. You know, this could get bad. Why?
I'm going to read you an article, and it's very, very quick. I don't know, you may have seen it. It was posted by a friend of mine to me today, and it's a quick snippet. It's titled "A Short Guide to the Middle East" by Mr. K. N. Al Sabah from London, and it says, "Sir, Iran is backing Assad. Gulf states are against Assad. Assad is against the Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood and Obama are against General Sisi. But the Gulf states are pro-Sisi, which means they are against Muslim Brotherhood. Iran is pro-Hamas, but Hamas is backing the Muslim Brotherhood. Obama is backing the Muslim Brotherhood, yet Hamas is against the US. Gulf states are pro-US, but Turkey is with the Gulf states against Assad. Yet Turkey is pro-Muslim Brotherhood against General Sisi, and General Sisi is backed by the Gulf states. Welcome to the Middle East, and have a nice day."
I hope the listeners, as they were hearing that, John, I hope the listeners were drawing all the little red lines from point to point. It looks like a bowl of spaghetti when you're done with it, but that's what I was doing in my head as you were reading that. The old expression, "What a tangled web we weave," certainly comes to mind.
And that is the problem. That goes back to what we were just saying now before we get on to Syria, mm-hmm. and that is the culture. Because it's part of the culture. It's part of the history. You have to understand not just the Middle East. You have to understand North Africa.
Oh, yes.
You have to understand now, depending on your point of view, you have to understand Middle Africa, Somalia, Ethiopia, and so forth, and how they have become over the years, for want of a better word, Islamified. You know, it's going further and further. So you have to take that all into consideration and look at it and say, right, okay, who's who and who is where and who's doing this and who's doing that and where are the friendships there? Where are the ties? Where are the political ties? Where are the religious ties? And once you've got that sorted, then you can begin to start to say, well, okay, shall we help those there and help those there, or do we help those in the middle? But if we help those in the middle, then those ones on there, they're not going to be happy. They're going to come over here. Then we've got the – that's the problem. Mm-hmm. It's keeping everybody happy. Everybody says bad things or has bad things to say about the former President Mubarak of mm-hmm. Egypt. But one thing I've always said about, and I will always maintain about Mubarak, and that is that he was an excellent diplomat. He kept the Middle East and Northern Africa in a kind of, not a status quo, but he kept a kind of position on the fence. He sat on the fence, that's quite right to say, but he kept a position on that fence where he could oversee everybody. a bit like the teacher in the playground.
Yes. Yes. And what's interesting is that, again, the people tend to want to demonize this leader or this leader, or feel that this person is, you know, the antithesis of what our humanitarian ideals are, when in truth sometimes the going gets rough, but it maintains stability. I guess the isolationist in me says that, yes, sometimes there are going to be problems in parts of the world, like Egypt, like Syria, but by the same token that our intervention may not alone be enough to create stability, and sometimes the apparent presence of instability in a culture different from ours, sometimes that is maybe the closest to true stability and true harmony that we will find, but we don't seem to really understand that completely. And it's troubling to me, because again, time and time, I see a lot of divisive discussion right now about the potential for America becoming involved in what's going on in Syria right now. Many people look at it and say, you know, there have already been more than 100,000 lives lost, or, you know, I don't know what the updated figures are. But the reasons for the fighting sometimes are not fully understood. I don't think they're hardly ever fully discussed in the media. And then furthermore, the motives behind the reasons for wanting to get in there, many would look at it as being humanitarian, but is that always necessarily truly the case? And will intervention create more harmony and more, or perhaps less chaos than what we're already seeing? Or will it actually set the stage for future chaos? One that we talked about just last night, John, was this, again, apparent revelation, and I laugh at that because so many people who are students of history have seen this and known this for years and years and years. And I do bring up again the 1954 coup in which Mohammad Mossadegh was removed from power in 1954, and the CIA's involvement with that, which institutes the Shah, and many would assert led to, on down the road, greater problems and issues that we still struggle with in the Middle East today. Do you feel like the same sort of thing could happen if indeed an intervention takes place in Syria? Will it actually create stability? I tend to think that I know what the answer to this question will be, but for the benefit of the listeners, I'll ask anyway. Or will it set the stage for more trouble on down the road?
I think we are. We've already set the stage. We set the stage many, 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 many years ago. We are merely playing out the next one of the next acts. I don't even know which act we're in. That's the problem. We seem not to be learning from our mistakes, for want of a better word. While I'm speaking to you, Mike, just to give you a heads up here, mm-hmm. I've got a map, and I'm looking at it. And I'm looking at Mauritania, I'm looking at Mali, Algeria, Morocco, Algiers, Tunisia, Libya, Niger, Chad, Sudan, Egypt, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Somalia, Kenya, Zaire, the Central Republic of Africa, Cameroon, Nigeria, you know, and I'm looking at those, and then I cross over the Red Sea, and I start to look at Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, Palestine, Syria, Iraq, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Oman, United Arab Emirates, Dubai, Kuwait, Turkey, Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and all, you know, you go through all of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, what's the big picture? What are we missing? Why are we hell-bent on trying to preserve some kind of democracy, or impose, shall I say, a political agenda, i.e. democracy, on these countries, and when they're not really ready for it? And then I can turn the table and say, are we actually really ready for it? Are we fooling ourselves? And that's one question I do ask myself sometimes, whether we are actually as democratic as we paint the picture.
I do too.
Because I don't think we are. I think I look at Syria now, and it's hemmed in there between Turkey and Iraq and Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine. And then we've got Iran on the other side. And I'm thinking, well, okay, we've got the Mediterranean there. And as I know today, that I'm sure you saw in the news, the American have moved its fleet. The British have moved their fleet. And quite rightly, we moved our fleet to Gibraltar because of Spain. But yes. One has to ask the question, was that a prelude for us to divert our fleet from the Middle East into the Mediterranean, knowing full well that we were going to go into Syria? Are we going into Syria because of the insurrection problems and the mounting insurrection problems in Iraq? Are we going into Syria because it's a doorway into Iran through Iraq? It allows us to have the Mediterranean, something that we haven't had before we've got a direct route then, a complete supply route if we wanted to go into Iran. You know, I look at these and I ask the questions, and some people will say, oh, this is conspiracy theories, John, and so forth. I say, well, fine, label it however you want to. I'm just merely putting forward my thoughts. I look at a map and I see what I see. I watch the news as everybody else does, and I listen intently, and I remove the garbage, I remove the rubbish that there's so much of, and I take the snippets of the important news, the actual facts that are there. And you start to read between the lines, and the Middle East and Northern Africa, there's something fundamentally wrong. And I'm going to use my words carefully here. There was something fundamentally wrong with the past 2 to 3 years. And that's a short period, but I'm only going to go back as far as the what they call the Arab Spring. And for me, it's a troubling matter, because you look at Tunisia, and I can't remember the name of the chap from Tunisia, unfortunately. I do apologize. The apple salesman who set himself alight as a protest against the police removing him and stopped him from selling. And it was the only way he could make a living. And so he set himself ablaze on fire as a protest. And that started the Arab Spring. And so we had our Tunisia, and then Morocco flared up, and Algeria flared up, and then Egypt flared up, and we had problems in Yemen, and we had problems in Kuwait, and in Bahrain, and in Turkey. And it has this snowball effect where one starts to look and think, well, okay, that's all been going on, that's all happened, but each country has been relatively peaceful. Afterwards, it has retained some kind of stability. Yet Syria has continued to be at odds with itself in a civil revolution for the past 2 years. And we haven't intervened. There have been no UN sanctions. No one has amassed at the borders. I haven't heard of Ban Ki-moon turning up and pitching a tent with the rest of the guys on the borders of Turkey. I haven't heard anything about the American army or the British or NATO or any of the coalition massing their troops on the borders of Iraq with Syria. I haven't heard anything. Nothing's over the past 2 years that's been going on. There's been no mention of this. The millions of refugees that have poured over the borders into Turkey and into Iraq and into Egypt, I might add. We are surrounded at this present moment with Syrians, actually here in Luxor. There are Syrians, it doesn't matter what street corner you're on, there are Syrians there unfortunately begging on the street because they have nothing. They have left in their millions. So one has to ask the question, why now? What is there to gain other than the stability of the country to go in there and put boots on the ground?
Exactly.
We're all, you know, the whole of Europe and America at the moment is in financial crisis. And you can paint as many colors and pictures over that as you want to, but we still are in financial crisis.
We really are, more so than people are aware.
And And you think to yourself, well, okay, we've got a couple of billion that we can spend on putting our ships into the Mediterranean and putting our boys on the ground in Syria to fight against who? Who are we fighting against? Who are we fighting for? What is the agenda? Are we fighting the Assad regime? Is he a dictator all of a sudden?
All of a sudden.
Do we have do we have categoric proof that he actually fired the missiles loaded with the chemical warheads?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think we were.
Well, I don't.
I haven't seen any reports come out of the United Nations inspectors.
We don't have that information yet, and they hadn't been allowed in for 5 days. But what's interesting is that the media is reporting on this, John, as though, based on the delay in you know, granting approval for UN inspectors to come in, that raises a red flag. If they wanted to cooperate with us, they would have let us in right away. And then furthermore, UN investigators are arriving today, and we hear that there were snipers firing at them. Again, we don't have all the story just yet. I really think that we need to be careful as we proceed. And I see, again, here in the West, the journalists, are tending to report on this, and even White House spokesmen who have been quoted. There was one who was unnamed, aside from merely being stated as a White House spokesman, but he'd spoken to ABC News yesterday and said, everything that we've been discussing here, there's concern about this chemical weapons attack. We hadn't gone in there yet to investigate, but because of this delay in access, this five-day period spanning before access was granted to UN investigators, this has aroused enough concern, and the media has already begun to report that this is perhaps grounds for concern. And they're talking about already laying out plans for intervention or for a quote-unquote strike. And it's incredible because there's so little information that's been garnered at this stage in the game.
Well, I've just received an email from the British Foreign Office, from the Right Honourable William Hague. And I've just highlighted the first paragraph of it, of his response. Mm-hmm. And I've just opened it as we've been speaking because it just came through. We are clear in the British government that it was the Assad regime that carried out this chemical attack, large-scale chemical attack last Wednesday that has led to the deaths, the anguishing deaths, of so many hundreds of people, including tragically so many children. All of the evidence points in that direction, in that one direction. But I didn't think we had any evidence.
It's interesting. What constitutes evidence? Now, granted, when people are being killed, especially when they're civilians, when they're children being killed, asking those questions is not to detract from the fact that there are deaths that actually occur. And since the beginning of what I guess we would call the Arab Spring, you know, going back to the 2011, there have been literally tens of thousands of deaths that have occurred, and injuries, and people who have become displaced and who have fled the region, and all different kinds of problems. And yes, we acknowledge all this, but again, you know, when we're talking about direct military action, this is a complex situation. And again, how much of the full story do we have? According to was it Mr. Hague? Correct me if I'm wrong there, the Right Honorable. Yes. According to him, apparently we are certain about this. But again, that's interesting because the UN investigators, correct me if I'm wrong again, only arrived in Syria today, did they not?
They did indeed. And they, as far as I'm aware, they haven't issued any report as yet.
Interesting. Very
but William
interesting.
Hague is good old... William has come out and said that all of the evidence points in that direction.
Well, interesting.
What is the evidence? Because we haven't been on the ground.
It's interesting.
Perplexing. You see, I asked a question. One of the questions that came to me with regards to this chemical attack, and you know, I can't condone it. 100% I can't condone it. But
yeah.
What comes to me, the question is that the Muslim Brotherhood are the ones who are at war, in inverted commas, with the Assad regime. Where, if it wasn't the Assad regime that fired the chemical attack, it's a hypothetical question.
Certainly.
Where would the Muslim Brotherhood acquire such chemicals? And my first attention is drawn to Libya. Mm-hmm. And their stockpiles of chemical weapons that we were told they had. But, as per usual, we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction when we went in. It was gone. At the time, Egypt was under the control of the Muslim Brotherhood. Is it inconceivable to hypothesize that the weapons or a selection of weapons made their way out of Libya, across Egypt, unhindered, across the Sinai into Palestine, and then from Palestine into Lebanon, and then from Lebanon straight into Syria?
Oh, I don't find it inconceivable at all. I don't think that is perhaps even an unlikelihood. Something about this, and just having this conversation, I have to, by the way, admit very briefly, John, that this is partially for selfish reasons that I talk with you about all this, because as you know, I'm interested in this, but by the same token, as we're discussing this and as we're unraveling all this, and I'm pulling up these news stories and I'm reading this, I'm trying very carefully to remain in the center on this, as I always do, and just see how things go. I see this getting worse before it gets better, and I found this quote, by the way, here, trying to get the proper term for the or the actual proper title of the individual who's speaking here. I believe that this is Minister Fazal Miqdad, the Syrian Deputy Foreign Minister. And this quote that he has issued today is that, quote-unquote, Syria will not be an easy target, and furthermore, that he did not elaborate. This was CBS News reporting earlier today. He did not elaborate on how Syria might defend itself, but he said that an attack, and he's talking about an attack against Syria carried out by the United States, would, quote, trigger chaos in the entire world. I see this getting worse before it gets better. Now, a brief disclaimer. People who listen to the Greyliad Report typically come here because they hear us discussing, this would certainly qualify to an extent as conspiratorial talk. They want to talk about the unexplained, the esoteric. We're going to get to that in a moment as well. But I maintain that we have these sorts of discussions on this program because people often are not getting, I think, truly a fair and a balanced perspective on these things when they read about them in the news. And furthermore, people often don't even read about this in the news. Here, I hope that hearing someone like John Ward discuss this, you know, very intellectual and a very intelligent and very involved person, halfway across the world in Luxor, Egypt, having this conversation, you know, with a Southern boy sitting here in Western North Carolina. I hope people are hearing this kind of discussion and realizing two people from opposite ends of the world are examining world affairs in a way that maybe you won't hear about on the news that is both compelling and also educational. It's important to know these things. It's important to learn these kinds of things and to read them without the hubris that often accompanies the way that media agencies, whether that be CBS News or Al Jazeera, the way that they will report that, you know. And John, I want to thank you also for talking about this a little with me today, because I want to get to your esoteric interests here in a moment just as well. But I do feel it's important to have these sorts of discussions and in the format in which we're having these discussions today.
There is one component that you haven't brought up yet.
Okay.
And that is the Russia and China
yes.
component.
Uh-huh.
All you have to do is do a quick research, background research on both countries, both Russia and China, and their involvement. And when I mean involvement, I mean economic involvement within Africa, especially northern and middle Africa. And when you start to look at the figures, and we're not talking millions, we're not talking billions, we're talking trillions of dollars that is being invested into near enough most of the countries that make up that area, the top part of Africa, basically, where they're buying up complete swathes of land. They're buying up all the mineral rights. They're buying up all the oil rights. They're building entire cities in exchange for these rights. They're building entire cities and infrastructure in exchange for allowing other infrastructure to be built, factories, because the wages are low. So they're able to manufacture at lower cost than they could at home. And they've got the raw materials there actually in a sustainable environment.
Right.
So one has to start looking at that and thinking, well, okay, if I have a huge financial interest in that particular part of the world, I need to guarantee, of course, my trade, and that be that by air or by sea or by road. And when you start to look at that infrastructure, the economic infrastructure that surrounds the trading point, the trading economics of the world itself, you can start to look at, again, take a map. So all you got to do is take a map and start to look at the lie of the land and start to look and see where the main ports are and where the main trading routes are. And then all of things start to kind, again, conspiracy theory here, but, you know,
that's
things
fine.
Do come. It makes a clearer picture. You start to see Iran, and you see Afghanistan, and you start to see Uzbekistan, and you start to see those kind of countries in a different limelight. Because if you had a main road that came down from Russia through Chechnya, through Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, through Iran, through Iraq, through Jordan, into Egypt, you've got the main African highway that supports Egypt and Sudan and Ethiopia, and then down into Kenya and Uganda and Zaire and so forth. You start to look at the Suez Canal in Egypt and the Red Sea ports. Then you start to think about Somalia and the pirates that we had all the problem, which is still ongoing, by the way. And then we start to look at Tunisia. And then all of a sudden, only within the last 3 or 4 weeks, we've got the problems with Gibraltar, which is the main artery into the Mediterranean. If we didn't own Gibraltar, we wouldn't be able to keep an eye on the Mediterranean, what comes in and what goes out. It's the only way in And it's the only way out other than the Suez Canal. So it starts to make a lot of sense what's happening in the world when you start to look at it in that way. But again, it raises more questions than answers, unfortunately.
It certainly doesn't.
But if it gets worse and the saber is rattled, so to speak, by the Europeans and America against Syria, it would be interesting to see which saber is picked up by China and Russia in retaliation for our own saber rattling. Ties between America and Russia are not exactly good at the moment, especially after the
Edward Snowden?
Missile deployment.
Oh, well, yeah.
Within NATO.
That was
very close to the borders, and that's still going ahead, and that's still a very controversial subject,
mm-hmm.
even though it's kind of lost its shine within the news at the moment.
Well, I don't think it's not as sensational as the Snowden aspect, which, again, may be the lesser of the two. That's more of like a bickering kind of thing, but it's the one that's sensational for the media. Nonetheless, though, a lot of people use it to illustrate the worsening relations and the growing tensions between America and Russia. But yes, continue.
Yeah. So for me, I like to keep an eye on the other components, which people don't really take them for granted. And for me at this present moment, Syria, yes, is the major problem. They've been saying that for quite a while here amongst conversations, that watch Syria, watch Syria, watch Syria. Whatever happens in Syria, Egypt is going to be following suit in some kind of way. It's a kind of thermometer in a way. But I said the main thing you have to watch is Turkey. Keep a very, very close eye on Turkey. Because if Turkey turns nasty,
mm-hmm.
They're already starting again the protests against the Muslim Brotherhood government, which is in power at the moment in Turkey. We've just got over one major protest where unfortunately there was loss of life. Which started with it was the park, wasn't it, where they were going to demolish the park and build some government building. And it kind of escalated from there and escalated into an anti-government protest. But I know that they've started again over the weekend. And so, again, is Turkey, are the people feeding? And this goes back to the cultural question, Mike, and that mm-hmm. is, you know, when you look at people today, they only have to turn on their television sets, or turn on their computers, even just turn on their mobile, and the news alerts that we get, and the Twitters and the Facebook reports that we get, it's instantaneous. And if you can rally 1,000 people, you can rally 10,000 people. And I think Turkey is now becoming the thermometer for the Middle East. Syria is kind of the gas underneath the pot.
Right.
The whole of Northern Africa and the Middle East is in the pot, and Turkey is now the thermometer. Because if Turkey boils over and goes into a civil strife and overthrows its government, it would be interesting to see which way it goes. Don't forget they have applied to become part of Europe as well. So they've got a lot to lose, a lot to gain as well at the same time. But again, it is a good thermometer for the area.
Absolutely. And again, looking at the aspect of the gas under the fire, as you had said, in regard to Syria, if the Syrian deputy foreign minister was correct in the statement he made earlier today about this will literally ignite chaos throughout the world, then I guess that's where we'll want to be looking. We'll have to see. And that's a frightening concept. So we'll have to take a very short break right there. But when we come back, maybe we'll change gears just a bit. This is a subject I could discuss so much and so often, unfortunately, but it is something that is timely and important just as well. But when we come back from this short break, I do want to get into the esoteric side of things with you, John. John Ward is our guest. He is the co-author of the upcoming book, The Exodus Reality. He'll also be hosting a tour themed around that book somewhat that we'll be discussing a little bit later just as well. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Grayling Report. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this. Imagine a place, beautiful, green, sloping mountains, and a rich, mysterious window into our ancient past. It's a culture the likes of which you won't find anyplace else. And while the place I'm describing is in Vermont, it's also the home of Inner Traditions, publishers of fine books on mind, body, and spirit for more than three decades. Inner Traditions are internationally recognized publishers of everything from occult to esoteric and spiritual books, as well as the leading authorities on alternative health, holistic healing, sacred sexuality, altered states of consciousness, and so much more. And frankly, it's not the kind of information you'll find just anywhere. Exploring the inner secrets of humanity requires thinking outside the box. And when it comes to Inner Traditions, the name says it all. All you have to do to learn more is visit innertraditions.com and you can receive a free catalog that will tell you all about their latest books and newest authors. That's Inner Traditions and Bear & Company, publishers of fine esoteric books for more than three decades. Find them online at innertraditions.com.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
In 2019, mysteries of the past will reshape our future. Paradigm Symposium 2013 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, October 17th through the 20th. Speakers will include Scott Wolter of History Channel's America Unearthed, Egyptologist Robert Bavall, Dr. Robert Schock, and many more. Tickets are available online at paradigmsymposium.com. Mankind's greatest mysteries brought to the present with new understanding. Visit paradigmsymposium.com.
Is the Grailian Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grailian Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And welcome back to the program. I am Micah Hanks, and we're picking up almost where we left off with John Ward in the last segment. It is the Grailian Report, and tonight we've been discussing, for the first portion of this discussion with John, we've been talking about the nature of what's going on in Syria, as well as other parts of the Middle East. I feel that it's something that is important to discuss, even on a program like the Grailian Report, because if we don't, we lay ourselves open and oblivious to aspects of reality that are very pertinent, very pressing, and they are very present, especially with regard to John in his literal physical location there in Luxor, Egypt. Now, coming off the heels of that discussion, something that, again, is very interesting and very timely, as well as very potentially stressful for people like me who really look at this and try and understand all the implications, I do want to change gears here. I do want to get over into the discussion of the esoteric angle to all this, because, again, John Ward is a person who is multifaceted and very talented in a number of areas, but also richly esoteric. I could talk about this all day. I want to do you the credit of being able to talk about the other aspect of your work, because, you know, being someone who is so observant of the issues going on in the Middle East right now, and you're able to talk about this, and I enjoy talking with you about it, it's important to address those kinds of things. On a podcast like this, typically people who deal with fringe subjects, they may get into this, because as you'd said, there's a conspiracy element to it, John, but by the same token, I see that the way that you present that conspiracy element
It's not in a sensational way at all. And certainly there is certain speculation being employed, but to me, speculation is okay if it's done in a reasonable way and that's not done in a way that involves overt sensationalism or fear-mongering, which is something I try to avoid. And, you know, again, I think it's fine to assert there may be something more going on here. This could be a conspiracy theory when presented in the fashion in which you've done so. I think you handled it eloquently, and I thank you for that. But now I want to do you the service of being able to move into your other interests. There's something that brought you to Egypt. Now, of course, you're the co-author of a book that's going to be coming out soon called The Exodus Reality, co-authored with Scott Roberts of Intrepid Magazine. Yep. And you and he co-host the program Intrepid Radio each Sunday night on Global Radio Alliance, which immediately follows the Micah Hanks program, which is wonderful for me because I get to talk to you guys at least for a couple of minutes every Sunday as our two programs. One's going off the air and one's coming. So when we're coming and going, we get to catch up for a moment. I don't get to sit and really talk to you like this. For my listeners who may not be as familiar with you and your work, you're a man from England, a man with a background in all different sorts of things, from marketing and sales to, of course, what you do today. What brought you to Egypt? What brought you to that part of the world that many would look at as the epicenter of chaos in our modern world? What brought you there? Why are you in Egypt today, and what is it that you, what is it in life that you're seeking and hoping to find there?
How does one answer such a question?
Yes, I'm good for those kind of questions, I suppose.
you've put me on the spot. Right, let's try and tackle this in a methodical way.
I'm sure you
will
succeed.
Why am I here first? Let's deal with that aspect first. Why am I here? Why am I in Egypt? And as you say, it's not exactly a rosy picture at the moment, or so it is portrayed. I left England nigh on 10 years ago now. The reason I left is very simple. I'd had enough. I'd had enough of the system. I was what you guys call a real estate agent. So in England, we are real estate agents, still are today. We're beneath the scum on the bottom of your shoe. We would sell our grandmother's soul to close a deal. And I did on many occasions, I must admit. It came to the point where I could see that what I was doing no longer gave me that buzz. And a lot of salespeople out there, that they understand this. When you're making a sale and you close the deal, there's a certain adrenaline rush that you get. It's like the dating game, isn't it? It's all part of the game, the hunt.
But those aren't enduring thrills.
And once you've got it, and you move on to the next.
Right.
And I had that. I don't mind saying I was damn good at it. And I earned,
I'd never guess.
A pretty penny from it as well, which allowed me to move. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, I can't be too negative about it. It facilitated everything that I wanted to do at that particular time. But I sold my house, lock, stock, and barrel, its contents, both my cars, beautiful Range Rover and a beautiful Audi. And my wife, who is now my ex-wife, by my dad, and my lovely children, we all moved out to Egypt to follow a mad dream of their father, who a lot of people thought at the time was having a nervous breakdown or midlife crisis, and thought, well, okay, we'll let him do it, and he'll get over it, and he'll come back, and he'll slot back into society again and conform. But I didn't. So sorry about that, chaps. And it was a kind of... It was a release. I just couldn't do it anymore. And so I'd been coming to Egypt on holiday, and I loved it anyway. And I loved the history, and it was a passion of mine, and it had been a hobby since I was a child. And I just wanted to continue that. But, of course, at the same time, reality, I had to provide for my family, and I had to provide some kind of stability and some kind of security and so forth, and some future and a house and everything else that goes with it that we would require. We weren't going to become hippies and live in a yurt in the middle of the desert. We weren't going to become Bedouins. I don't think my wife would have allowed that, really. So I had to devise a plan which facilitated not just my own personal interests from a selfish point of view, but also the interests of my family and the interests of my children, of course, and to keep everybody happy, keep the equilibrium, and allow the process to happen. So it facilitated the future. So everything worked. And so I devised a quick plan to do a tour company, which would keep everybody busy. The children were installed into schools and so forth, and I then went and diverted off and did my archaeological bits and pieces, and haven't stopped since. Along the road, there were a few bumps, shall we say? But those bumps were already there, let's be honest about it. Those bumps were there, and we knew they were there, and unfortunately, we just tried covering them over or patching them over, as most people would say, I suppose. But they didn't go away, and they kept on resurfacing. So at the end of the day, it was call time, and we continue as we are today. My family removed themselves from Evelyn, moved back to England, and I remained here. And here I am now with Maria.
Indeed.
10 years on. So, sorry, go on. Yes.
No, I have to also mention Maria very briefly. The beautiful better half to John Ward. Hard to imagine there being a better half to John Ward. And yet there she is.
She is. She is the better half. She's everything. Without her, I would not have accomplished half of the work I've accomplished so far. I will be honest. I have to give her the credit for this. She is not just only a slave master, but she's a damn good slave master, and she's damn good with it as well. She knows how to motivate me. She knows how to get results. And she's a very, very good teacher, a very good teacher. And I've learnt so much. I couldn't even begin to start where how much I've learned from her. But it's this, the relationship and living here has also allowed me to tap into aspects of myself that a lot of people don't have the opportunity to do, I suppose. And I've been writing about this recently, actually. I've been trying to put down my memoirs in a chronological order. It's quite funny, really. When you start reminiscing, you start putting it down in a chronological order, and you start. And here I am, writing about 2006. Well, what happened in 2006, John? So you start from January, you carry on, and then all of a sudden, before you know it, you're at 60,000 words, and you haven't got past January.
Well, you know, there's another problem with that, John, too. When you begin getting into the esoteric, and your mind and consciousness begin to evade temporality slowly but surely, you have a little bit of difficulty keeping things in that chronological order. So I hope that you're still able to do that.
So.
You know, John, I have to also assert here, I've heard you referred to as, at least on one occasion, an occultist. Do you feel that that is a proper terminology? do you think that term fits who you are? And if so, or if not, for that matter, why? Were you aware, maybe, that you've been referred to as an occultist?
Right. When I first heard that, I was quite taken aback, I must admit. If you'd said this to me, or if I'd heard someone call me an occultist 10 years ago, I would have been quite embarrassed and rather upset by it, I will be honest. When I heard this, and it was only I think it was last month or the month before I heard this, I was actually quite proud. I was quite chuffed. I thought, oh. And I became pigeon-chested. And I felt quite good about myself. Someone's referred to me as an occultist. My research has finally paid off. I've arrived. It's kind of weird. And we touched upon this, actually, in the Exodus reality between me and Scotty on our faith issue. Our religion, our religious background, and how we dealt with the questions of Moses and so forth. And I quite openly write about this in the book, about having been a Christian and a practicing Christian at that, but having lived here for so long and doing the research that I have done and continue to do, I have somewhat lost, not somewhat, have lost, full stop, my faith. I no longer believe in what would terminology be here, religion, the Christian religion. I don't believe in it. I don't believe in the Holy Trinity. It's very difficult to have faith in something of that kind of nature when you are surrounded by objects personalities and actual physical remnants of something that is phenomenally far older. And for me, that was a juxtaposition, and I just couldn't deal with it. I just couldn't deal with it. There's a lovely little bit I wrote in the book about myself, where I said, I relegated myself to the back pews of the church, fumbling through my Book of Common Prayer, looking for answers that I knew no longer existed. And I think that summed up really where I am with my Christian upbringing and my Christian belief, because it's not there anymore. Now, this is very important to point out here. Just because I've been called an occultist doesn't mean I'm a Satan worshiper.
Of course not.
Doesn't mean, you know, an occultist is somebody, I like to view the word occultist as somebody who has gone through the veil of mainstream religion, has then gone through the journey of, shall we use the word, spirituality, and has journeyed through that search, that quest for themselves, through the various different techniques that are out there, gone through the assortment of gurus, past and present, and gone through the metaphysical, gone through the physics, the scientific, and ended up at the end of it with a title of occultist, because there isn't anything else left, really. I mean, you can call yourself an alchemist. Well, I'm not an alchemist. I would like to think I'm an occultist. I dabble here, there, and everywhere, I suppose. But I don't have any one following. I don't pertain to, or I don't even begin to say that I believe in one religion or the other anymore.
You know, a cult, though, really...
It's kind of interesting.
It is interesting. And a cult really only... I mean, it gets a bad rap these days, you know, especially because, again, it is a widely held view. And, you know, it's not my intention to assert whether it is wrong or right. I merely assert that it is. And especially here in America and in the West, it is this concept that we are founded as a Christian nation. That philosophy and that way of life and that belief is what steers, if you will, the moral compass. And as we get further and further away from that, society and the goodness in society tends to have degraded over time. Now, I don't know that we can necessarily say that the symptom of our removal from religion in American society, for instance, is what we see going on in the streets right now, which really may not be as bad as some would like to think. I wonder often if people in the Middle East who read about Western news think that it's a constant ongoing race war over here, because that doesn't seem to be the case. It's just the media likes to focus on one, two, three, or four, you know, highly popularized, one in specific, racial incident or what appeared to be a racially involved crime. And of course, yes, I'm speaking about Trayvon Martin. Again, I think we can talk about that without having to step away and say that there wasn't a tragedy there. Of course, if a person is killed, it's a tragedy. But again, that is not, to me, representative of what's going on across the board in America. And furthermore, that if there are problems, that it's necessarily that people are backing away from faith. I also think it's healthy to question whether or not you want to call it faith, spirituality, religion. You have to question everything, and only in questioning can one come to a more complete understanding of themselves and the nature of reality and what is of value to them. By doing that, I don't think that that removes a person from, you know, the hallowed, you know, justifications and the beauty of being right and good and holy. An occult person, a cult actually only means study of mystical or supernatural or magical beliefs and practices. To me, religion falls under that jurisdiction very much. And yet,
of course it does, because you've just used labels that are have been placed on there by the Christian church or by the dogma. And so, because it goes against the church, therefore it's a negative, therefore it must be bad, and therefore it must be against the church, and must be against all scripture and Jesus Christ and the Trinity and everything else. And so, therefore, it is bad.
And hence what is inferred is that it is
while
satanic.
While you were talking there, I was reminded of the first time we met.
Oh, God.
I don't remember if you – we were having a very heated discussion. The parameters of that discussion evade me at the moment. But I remember saying this to you. In order to remain neutral – you asked me about how I arrived at some certain answer. Mm-hmm. And I said the way I do it is to remain neutral is to remove all dogma, to remove all morals, to remove all conformity. and to remove all conditioning of one's life. And if you can successfully do all that and sit or stand or whatever you're going to do in that position without all that around you, you can then clearly answer a question in neutrality. If you have just one iota of anything, any one of those subjects hit you or is in your mindset when you are trying to answer, then it has become a biased answer. And I think that's the beauty of being an occultist, I suppose, because you're able to remove those items that affect one's judgment and affects one's thought process. Because ultimately, whenever you sit down and you want to discuss something and you want to come to a logical conclusion or a logical argument or a debate or a discussion or what have you, if you allow those parameters to fall in, your answer or your rhetoric or your articulation will become biased.
It certainly will. And it's so funny, I see that. It's not funny at all, actually. I often find it humorous, but really it's disgusting the way that people unknowingly but inevitably allow dogma to color everything that they do. I see this in belief versus skepticism. I love how people who are skeptics somehow were miraculously born into, again, and I utilize this in reference to the modern use of the term, a skeptic who believes nothing without absolute hard proof evidence in front of them, and hence God does not exist, hence there's no need for the study of spirituality or the you know, enigmatic therianthropic gods of ancient Egypt or any other culture. There's no need to discuss all these things and study them because it's all something that is so far removed from our ability to perceive in logical and factual terms that there's virtually, as a skeptic would say, nothing there. Now, that's what I mean when I talk about skeptics, but yet I find that they often have that same dogma and that they are, again, magically somehow predisposed to being able to see the world in a way that is, quote-unquote, smarter than everyone else. Both political sides, right and left, or, you know, up and down for that matter, everyone does it. Everyone does it, and everyone thinks that they are right. And yes, I agree that, you know, whether you want to look at it from the occult perspective or from the political perspective, really, I think, in truth, at the base of it all, that they're one and the same, that point in the center is the only place where you can stand and look all around you and see 360 degrees, isn't it?
Well, that's the... Yeah. You're getting to the point within... As you know, and a few of you listeners are aware of this, in my office here in Luxor, I've got a 12-meter board, a whiteboard, and it spans the entire office. And it's laden with different names and little pictures, little tiny thumbnails of the individuals, just because my memory is as rubbish as a Swiss cheese.
It's all the coffee you drink.
But it shows clear lines. And I bring this up because when you said there, that central point, and for me that central point is the point in which there are certain... what's the word which we use here? Not individuals, not groups, not societies, but a gathering, a lineage of people. Some of your listeners out there are probably saying, oh, it's the elite, John. It's the elite. It's the New World Order. It's you know, it's the Georgia Guidestones. I told you it was the Guidestones all along. it's those kind of people. Don't get me onto the Guidestones. I love those things. You know what I always say when anybody brings the Guidestones to me and they say, "Oh, John, have you seen the Guidestones? How they're evil! It's the whole Masonic." I say, "Well, I am actually a Mason myself, but they're not evil." I said, "Turn it around." I said, "What if they're not there as a proclamation of destruction, but they're there for the ones who are left afterwards as, get this, a guide."
Yeah, imagine that.
Hence the word Guidestones. They're there for the survivors. I said, what if they're for the survivors? And the person who put them there actually knew what was going to happen.
Or they didn't.
It's just an if. It's a big if.
Yes, maybe they were just working in anticipation of human nature.
Well, you just think about it. Logically speaking, they've put every language there. They've told you what to do, how to live your life, what laws to implement, and how to do it all. And you think to yourself, well, okay, well, you're saying all this. Are you saying this pre-cataclysmic event, or are you saying this post-cataclysmic event?
Interesting perspective.
Just a question there.
Interesting
perspective there for the guide stance. But for me, going back to that central point, that group, that individual, or individuals, the elite, the New World Order, for me, it's a guiding, I call it the guiding hand. I call it the fourth line. I have two names for it. I call it the fourth line because on the board, physically, there is a fourth line that's missing. There's a gap, and it's a blank space, basically, that runs across my board. And it should be there, but it's not. There's no one in it, yet the board dictates that there should be somebody in there, but they're not. And it's this whole line is just blank. And so I call that the fourth line. And then I also use in other circles the guiding hand. Mm. It's as if there are, and some will say this is very conspiracy, but you know, it's as if there is somebody or a group of people or institutions, governmental or higher, that have manipulated certain events, of course, throughout history, going back to what you said earlier about Iran and the CIA and so forth, 1954, we can pick out various, and we could be here all night discussing this, all various historical dates and events that we know now through the release of certain documents and so forth, that they have been manipulated, and the answer or the ramifications of which were predicted, and that is what needed to happen, and so therefore it was put into play and XYZ. But I kind of go deeper with that. And within that is a phenomenal amount of esoterica and hermetics. You know, most of the grand names like Dr. John Dee, Ashmol, going backwards and forwards and so forth, they're all over the place. The Masons there, Aleister Crowley is there, Helena Blavatsky is there, Gurdjieff is there. You know, all these guys, they're all there, part and parcel of it. And it's kind of interesting when I start to look at that, because it's very, I must admit, it's a little bit difficult to put into words in such a short period of time. But they all play their own key points, their key actors, characters on that stage that we talked about at the very beginning. They all have a part to play on that stage, and their X's are marked on the boards, and they walk either left or right off stage, right on, do their part, and then depart. And we don't know as the audience where that X is on the stage. They know, because it's predetermined for them, and they're aware of that. And we don't know what the ramifications are going to be, but they know because they've read the script. Scotty said one thing to me it's one of the best things I've ever heard. And he said, if life is a play acted out on the stage, then if we are individuals, as in, i.e., the audience, and we take our seat, we see the play being acted out from a certain perspective. However, there is nothing to say that we cannot get up and take a different seat in a different part of the auditorium to view the play from a different perspective. And there is nothing to say that we cannot do that more than once, more than twice, infinitesimal. And I find that one of the most profound things someone's ever said to me. And I must praise Scotty for saying that.
I like that better than the allegory of the cave, in fact. You know? Because, I mean, surely there is a, to evoke the terminology from the example that I've utilized here. Again, yes, there is a shadowy aspect to what we observe in reality, just as much as there is. And the intention here, of course, philosophically, is that we're not getting the whole picture. But then again, you know, what you see taking place on a stage, it appears to be real. It appears to be a physical representation of some reality, and yet it is also an orchestrated reality. And what's interesting is that despite the fact that it may be orchestrated from one side of the stage, or the curtain for that matter, we as individuals observing can nonetheless move and take different perspectives of that. Yes, very deeply philosophical, very interesting. And I have to say, too, that that's the only thing that I regret about working so closely at times with Scotty Roberts, is that my ability to have those philosophical discussions with him at times is diminished, just because of the time of the day. you give us a 36-hour day, maybe we'll all catch up at some point. And speaking of time, since I don't want to take up too much more of yours, I want to, before we wrap up, I want to ask you about one more individual. You brought up a number of names, Helena Blavatsky and, of course, Aleister Crowley, both of whom I have been fascinated with for a long time. I don't think, again, that that makes you wicked or evil just because you're interested in Crowley. And frankly, I think that if people actually studied Crowley's interests, for good or for ill, there's a lot of interest, a lot of interesting things that one can glean from studying that man and what he perceived as the path. At times it was brilliant, at times it was filthy. But, you know, the thing is that that man was on what he believed to be a path to try and understand reality. I don't think that he was per se, he certainly called, but he did black magic. But I want to take it back further than Crowley even. I want to go back to this enigmatic character in history that we know as Dr. John Dee. I know that you share a mutual fascination with him, and maybe we'll wrap things up after that, but I wouldn't feel good about leaving this conversation without asking about Dr. John Dee, someone who you are fascinated with, and I know for a fact that you also bear his portrait upon the wall there in your study. Am I correct?
He is indeed.
Yes, he is. I see now whose eyes.
Fascinating character.
Was he influential for you?
He has actually been very... He for me, is like a mentor, I suppose. I think that's the best way to put him. He's a mentor. He has been replaced, unfortunately, by Amenhotep, son of Hapu now.
Oh.
Nevertheless, he is a mentor. He's one of the guys that stand out from the crowd. He was way before his time, way before his time. What intrigues me is the amount of tales that surround him. The stories of myth and legend and so forth, and I love the way in which without being rude or crash to those lovely people out there, these spiritualists, they kind of embrace him and they embroil him with these tall feats sometimes it's beyond the pale. He's one of these enigmatic chaps who stands out for me, let's put it that way,
sure,
in history. He knew or was within the company of Queen Elizabeth I, another major influence on my life. And he was in that era, the Tudor era, where the world, especially Britain at the time, the United Kingdom, was becoming, it was going through its renaissance. You know, we were there. Queen Elizabeth, she was in charge. This formidable queen. We got rid of the Catholics, and her father had installed the Church of England. She was trying to keep the country together while trying to fight the Catholics on one side, keep the Protestants happy on the other side, and then you had the Jewish influence as well. And at the same time, she had the New World. She had the Spain banging on her door. She had the French banging on her door. She kind of kept it all in harmony. She kept it all in balance. And she has this kind of air about her as if she was never fazed by it. And I love that. And John Dee, for me, he personifies this kind of father figure to her. And rightly or wrongly, but this is my own interpretation.
Oh, sure.
He was there like the school teacher, you know, the aged professor that you at school you kind of cling to. Mm-hmm. You may not have ever been in his classes, but you look at him and you feel as if you should bow when he walks through the halls past you and so forth. You think, there goes somebody of substance. And John Dee for me is that man. Apart from his esoterica and his alchemical work and so forth, which is vast, and if you ever get the chance to read some of his books, do, even though even I have trouble reading them sometimes and making sense of it, because it's not easy stuff to get into. You've got to be really in that frame of mind. And again, you know, as you know, Mike, with the research that we do at Gebel's Silla, a lot of that is, 90% of it is to do with symbolism. Mm-hmm. Ancient Egyptian symbolism, which they've used as mason marks, to coin the phrase, to mark out the stone and so forth. And there's a lot more to it. But John Dee came up as one of those guys that kind of worked within that kind of sphere of symbolism. He evidently believed in that a particular symbol held within it a certain intent, and that intent either had a negative or positive response, and he would wield that symbol and its intent and place it with other symbols to have an incantation, which, call it a spell if you want to, which would have its desired effect, or he would use it to place an intent on a particular object, or empower something, or empower himself, or empower somebody else, again using also his alchemical works and so forth. I mean, some of the stories are fantastic.
Now, very much
he's
the occultist.
He's a lovely man.
Yes, and very much the occultist, the epitome of, again, by definition, what we would call an occultist. John Dee was also, of course, a devout Christian as well. You know, and a lot of people don't seem...
Yes.
They have a lot of trouble weighing those two against one another. This man believed so devoutly. His faith was so strong.
But, Michael, you have to remember the time period.
Mm-hmm, yes.
You have to remember the time period. And as we always say, the victors write the books. Oh. And at that particular time period, Christianity was fundamentally the rule. There was no gray area. Yet John Dee was the gray area. Mm-hmm. But, of course, the history books write and have been written, and we read within their leafy pages that he is a devout Christian. How do we know? We weren't there.
No.
Was he?
Good question.
He was a fantastic occultist, and he was a fantastic alchemical professor. I mean, the guy was fantastic in all aspects of the occult. So why would he then be a practicing Christian? That those two don't really go together. I think that he was a practicing Christian because he had to be to save face, and it wasn't burnt at the stake either for witchcraft and other such misdemeanors.
Now, you know, I would juxtapose that with another line of thought, which may be that I often see, and this is just for the sake of argument here, but allow me to play devil's advocate for a moment. We see this conflict today between science and religion, whereas for me personally, you know, and again, I call myself a universal spiritualist. I, like you, have a Christian upbringing. My father is an Episcopal priest, very much an esoteric thinker himself. Where do you think I get all of this? But, you know, again, my father also instilled in me a desire to want to learn and to want to study, whether that be, you know, ancient history, mysteries, things like that, you know, certain aspects of the occult. You know, I certainly know that my father, being an Episcopal priest, is not a practicer of what we might call the occult, but he's certainly also been very interested in the history of that sort of thing, and also, you know, secret societies and ancient rites and rituals. Now, I see that in the modern world, we see this kind of dichotomy, this polarization between scientific thought and then religious or spiritual thought, which is by most people, I would say, on the academic science side, viewed largely as being fundamentalist, innately fundamentalist. Whereas I don't think that a person has to renounce all religion and spirituality. I mean, if it's right for you, go ahead. But I don't think that a person has to do that in order to be able to be scientific just as well. Now, for his day, again, being a man of science just as well, talking about all the good things that, you know, John Dee was skilled with, he was also an incredibly skilled mathematician. I think he'd worked as a linguist, obviously. And he was very, very, very devoutly scientific, just as well as what history portrays as being devoutly religious. But maybe that same dichotomy that people want to assert wouldn't have to exist there either. Maybe he could be all things, occultist, you know, scientist, you know, spiritualist, without having to say, I could not be because I cannot be both. He was that man to me that brings us back to the center of the argument that we've been having. You know, that he's that man at the center, and that person who realized that in the gray area, as you termed it, John, in that center, he could learn all things without having to renounce one or the other. Just a thought, just a different perspective.
No, Mike, I can't argue with you. You know, that's what I love about discussion and debate.
Indeed,
is that you can put so many different theories on the table, and personally, myself, I never put a theory to the table and say, right, that's it. It's like Exodus. I didn't put the theory onto paper and say, right, this is it. This is how it's going to be. This is concrete. Scotty's is completely flawed, and he's wrong. The Bible is completely wrong. Yes. You know, I didn't go out and say that. I merely make a suggestion. And I suggest this, and I suggest that. And I entertain debate, and I entertain discussion. Because through discussion and through debate and through continued articulation and theorizing, we learn. And when we stop talking and communicating is the day we stop learning. And this is returns to our very beginning of our conversation, Syria. When the conversation stops, war breaks out.
Oh,
whether it and be at a- the moment, Iran, for me, are the ones who have stopped talking. And they're the biggest worry. The biggest worry.
Yes.
And I think, you know, you go back to the days of John Dee, and you go back to the days of Queen Elizabeth I, and the Star Chamber, and the discovery of the New World, and so forth. And you look at the way in which the European royal houses clambered together to slice up the New World. It's very we haven't changed. We're still there. We're just doing it with Africa,
right,
and the Middle East. We still think we're colonial powers.
Mm.
I mean, me being a Brit, you know, and you know me, I'm very, very royalistic. And
sure.
I believe in the colonial powers. But at the same time, we've got to be respectful of individual nations.
Yes.
And if Syria is going through some birthing pains, and there is death, and there is violence, and there is famine, and there is drought, and the people are dying in their tens of thousands, and there are millions driven out across the borders, what is our responsibility? Is it to go in with boots and guns, or is it to go in with aids, packages of food, medical supplies, and a big round table where we can sit everybody down and say, right, we're not going to leave until everybody has said their piece?
Indeed. One would be the true humanitarian effort. One may also be more easily said than done.
Of course.
Yes.
In a real world. In the real world.
But I see exactly what you're saying. And it's enriching to discuss things on those terms, as has been every moment of this argument. I'll tell you this. I keep saying argument because we're weaving a narrative of, in a sense. It's really a conversation. I don't mean argument in the sense of opposing viewpoints. But at times there will be opposing viewpoints, as I'm afraid that we will probably see in the future. There will continue to be opposing viewpoints elsewhere in the world, and that's why we'll have to have you back on again in the future to discuss those. My dear friend John Warden, I'll tell you this, and I'll leave you with this, this was one of those days where I needed the level of enrichment that this conversation has provided. I know already, but I sincerely hope that the listeners feel the same. I know that they do. That's why they listen to this program. And thank you for being with me on the Graylian Report. John, where can people find out more about you and your work and your continued efforts in the Middle East?
Well, the best place really these days now, of course, unfortunately, is Facebook. I mean, it is everything. I do everything on Facebook. It's the most easiest way now, through Instagrams and Twitters, my LinkedIn accounts, my Academia Edu accounts. It all linked through Facebook, you know, the great guru in the sky. Facebook does everything. You can find us there, the Sirius Projects. You can find the Gebel El Sisila Survey Project on there. You can find my Esoteric Brotherhood of Luxor, where we discuss everything esoteric. You can find the Exodus Reality and the adventures that me and Scotty we're bringing forward for next year, February. We've only got 8 places left, by the way.
Oh, gosh.
And if you buy one, you get a free ticket.
Tell us about
that. The biggest ticket, I believe it is, to Paradigm.
Oh, really? Now, tell us a little bit about it, but yeah, because we're coming up on that Paradigm Symposium. You'll be speaking at Paradigm in October, and so for folks who want to meet this erudite and incredible gentleman, Dr. John Ward, you'll need to come to Paradigm Symposium, but then there's the Exodus Reality Tour in February. You know, I hope to be joining you there just as well. Tell us a little bit about that before we let you go.
We are hoping you're going to be there, Micah. I need somebody to make my coffee for me.
I make good coffee. I need someone who will drink it with me, so come on.
Well, we are only taking 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
There is going to be no more, and hopefully no less, but no more than 10. so we can keep it completely personable. And we will be starting in Cairo and working our way over into the Sinai to Serabit El Khidim, which both me and Scotty discuss in our book at length, as the mountain of God, where Moses himself received the Ten Commandments. And we go into the reasons behind and the archaeological evidence that's there today. And you'll be able to see that when you come with us on the tour. Then we'll finish with Sinai, and we'll travel onwards down to Luxor, Thebes, the ancient city of Thebes, and we'll be viewing all the sites here on both the East Bank and the West Bank, the Valley of the Kings, Medinet Habu, Hatshepsut, the Ramesseum, Karnak, Luxor Temple, of course the Nile, and then we will take a dahabiyah down the Nile. So we'll cruise down the Nile in style, as they did during the 19th century. We'll be stopping off at sites such as Edfu and Komombo and Gebel El Sarsila, eventually arriving in Aswan, where we'll see all the sites in Aswan, Philae, the unfinished obelisk, the island of Elephantine. And then we will leave Aswan, and we will travel all the way right down through Lake Nasser down to the phenomenal site of Abu Simbel, where the huge megalithic statues of Ramesses overlook the Lake Nasser now. And we will then return to Cairo. Of course, you've got the Giza pyramids, you've got the Sphinx, the Egyptian Museum, Memphis, Saqqara, and everything else that's in Cairo as well that we'll be viewing. And it's going to be an amazing 14 days. Wow. It's going to be non-stop. And we're going to have some guest speakers as well. You're going to be there as well, Micah. We're going to roll you in for one of the guest speakers, I think. So we're going to have a phenomenal time. I can't wait. I'm really, really looking forward to it. But we've only got 8 tickets left. And if you buy your ticket before Paradim, you get a free biggest ticket as complimentary from us.
Wow.
So it's well worth going for.
You won't find a better 2-for-1 deal than that. The website again for the Exodus Reality Tour.
It's just exodusrealityadventures.com.
Excellent. Yes, people,
simple.
Please take simple. A look at that. You know, and where else would you be able to travel in one of the most rich and enigmatic parts of the world with the likes of Scotty Roberts, John Ward, and, well, yours truly. Now, the final thing about that, too, is I know that there will be people who will say, that part of the world I don't want to go to right now. You live there. You hold a different perspective. This is something that would be not only worthwhile but also safe, too, correct?
Well, this goes without saying. Personally, I would not be doing the trip. I would not be advertising the trip if I felt that it wasn't safe. Full stop. There's no wrangling there. There's no discussion. If I felt that any part of that trip was going to be unsafe, we wouldn't be doing it. I know everybody. In fact, and hand on heart here, I know all the inspectors at all the sites. I speak to them regularly, of course, from my own job and from my research. They're all reporting back. We don't have any problems on any of those sites. The transportation links are all there, up and running, no problems there at all. And we'll be flying backwards and forwards. We've got the boat, our own personal boat, and our own personal transport. We have our own personal guards, and we have our own personal staff. And I can't wait. It's going to be phenomenal.
Fantastic.
And it's going to be a laugh. I mean, seriously, wow. It's going to be one hell of a laugh. It really is. Yeah. Following in the footsteps of Moses, or for Scotty, Senemut, and for me, Amenhotep, son of Hapu, and for you, Micah, of course, John D.
Yes, indeed.
it's going to be phenomenal. It really is. And I'm looking forward to hopefully getting some great guest speakers that are going to be joining us on the trip as well.
I'll be certain to wear my Monos Hieroglyphici when I come, okay? And and now that we've qualmed the naysayers, because I know that there have been a few, indeed, that sounds like the tour to want to go on. And again, of course, don't forget that 2-for-1 deal, because, you know, you can also get a biggest ticket to the Paradigm Symposium with that deal that John has talked about. ExodusRealityAdventures.com is where to find that. John, much continued success. My dear brother, so good to talk to you. I can't wait to sit down and have a cup of coffee and a heated discussion with you, my dear acquaintance, at the Paradigm Symposium.
I can't wait either, Michael. It's been a pleasure. It really has. Thank you very much.
Well, we should do it more often, and I'll bid you adieu for this evening. But until next time, my friend, as we say here on the Graylin Report, stay strange. I know you will. And with that, we're going to wrap it up. This has been another edition, a special edition of the Graylian Report. You know, life sometimes moves so quickly. It goes by so fast. And I'll be honest, you know, full disclosure with my listeners who mean the world to me, every one of you out there. We've been working so hard in preparation for this incredible event that's going to be Paradigm Symposium. I've been spending so much time behind the computer and so little time out in the beautiful countryside of Western North Carolina that I've lived here my entire life, but I love it more and more every day. And sometimes you have to be able to back away. Now John told me again that off the record, of course, before we began our conversation, that he'd had kind of a rough day. And after the last week I had, I wanted to be able to do a show that was less, okay, news, go, fast paced. And that steps back and, yes, we look at timely things. Yes, we look at important issues. Yes, we examine all the things that we would always look at on a program like the Graylian Report, but we do it in a way also that removes us to an extent from the bombardment of the everyday that we are constantly faced with by media and by the stresses of existence, both good and bad, in fairness. And so, for me, this was just a wonderful way to be able to step aside, talk with someone who I'm very much looking forward to seeing at Paradigm Symposium, and perhaps spending some time with he and his lovely, and of course our dear friend Scotty Roberts over across the great pond that is the Atlantic a little earlier in the next year. But again, it's a nice way for me to kind of unwind, and I hope sincerely that the listenership have enjoyed as much as I have this conversation with Dr. John Ward. He's truly an incredible individual, and he's someone that you'll be hearing from quite a bit more in the future. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the program. I'm Micah Hanks, as always, and do again take a look at ParadigmSymposium.com through September the 4th, which is a Wednesday. We are going to be offering those special, very, very special discounted rates for a limited time only. This is probably going to be the last really good opportunity to get a special deal on Paradigm Symposium tickets, and so definitely check that out. On behalf of all of us here at the Graylian Report, I'm Micah Hanks, along with Dick Oakley, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, and all of us here at Graylian International. We bid you adieu, my friends. I remain the mouth of the South, Micah Hanks, and until next time, as always, my dear friends, stay strange. We'll talk to you next week.
Listening to the Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.